Right now, at the Kansas City Art Institute's Crossroads Gallery, there's a sculpture that can only be described as a Stonehenge of armchairs. One's corduroy, one's plaid, they're sort of stacked in a bizarre configuration. Nearby, the letters of the alphabet are covered in hot pink tinsel. They hang from a giant spinning rack like Pee-wee's Playhouse meets Sesame Street. These are visions brought to life from Christopher Leitch's dreams. The artist has kept meticulous dream journals for more than 40 years. And with this exhibit, he's taken the project one step further. He's brought recurring objects from his dreams to life through sculpture. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about dreams this chilly morning with Christopher Leitch on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Christopher.
Good morning. Thank you so much for asking me to be here.
Thanks for coming. When did you start keeping dream journals?
Well, I think a better question for me might be, when did I start remembering my dreams? And my earliest—
That is a better question.
It's as good a question. My earliest memories are recurring dreams I had as a child. And they were always a part of my mental landscape and my conversation with myself. And when, as a teenager, I was introduced to journaling and, diarying and being able to draw experiences in my life, that was the first place I turned, because my vivid dreams are a daily companion with me in waking life. And I just wanted to see if I could have a deeper relationship with them.
When you had, you said you had really vivid dreams and recurring ones as a child. Can you tell me about, do you remember any of them?
Oh, sure. And I've drawn them a lot. One dream was really abstract imagery that I understood represented my mother and father. And they were both there with different characters, qualities, and colors. And I had that dream repeatedly throughout my childhood. And another dream is a very common one for a lot of kids to have. I was being chased down railroad tracks by the mummy, Frankenstein, and werewolf, and Dracula. And my family were being picked off one by one. And I was the one up in front, running, trying to get away.
So I want to talk about your process for documenting and illustrating your dreams, because some of the pages are on the gallery walls and they're carefully typed. You've stamped a date on every entry. You've either drawn or painted the scene. These are not just some notes that you jot down.
No, there are several steps, and this process is fascinating to a lot of people. To me, it's a kind of a chore. But I do make notes either waking up in the middle of the night or right when I get up in the morning. I write a good reminding description of what that dream experience was. And later, part of my studio practice is writing, and writing in great detail about these dreams. I think initially, some years ago, I hoped that someone would be able to read the dream description and be able to draw a picture or a diagram of where everything happened and what was going on, and what the point of view was of the dreamer. I think that process—
Yeah, because you'll often, you refer to yourself in these notes as C.
That's right.
And then you often put in really detailed descriptions of, like, yeah, where C is standing and therefore, you know, what his line of vision is. You are kind of like, it's almost like a script for a play, so that someone could set it all up and do the set. Does, you know what I mean?
I like that you see it in that way, because they are kind of cinematic or operatic or dramatic sometimes. I think for me, the practice is trying to know my mind better and trying to be disciplined and trying to be objective and not be swayed by what I think or feel about symbolism or other aspects of the dream, but to try to understand that experience almost like someone painting a still life or doing a nature study or drawing a nude.
The bananas leaning on the orange.
Exactly. And how the shadow interacts with the surface of the table differently than with the orange peel. I think that discipline has been the best for me as an artist and as a writer, especially trying to get to the details and also get to the point and trying to balance the two.
So you jot down notes in the middle of the night and in the morning. You type them up at some point later, like flesh them out.
Yeah.
And you stamp the date on them, which feels very, it's like you're preparing your taxes.
That's funny that you would say that. Well, the date stamp accompanies my drawings. And the pages that you see in the gallery are pages that I've laid out in order to draw on them. And I leave a little space where the text flows around the space for the drawing. But I often am not very disciplined about staying in that little space. As you may have noticed, these drawings sort of careen all over the pages.
I actually like that a lot.
Thank you. And I like to document when I did the drawing versus when I had the dream and recorded the dream. So you'll see two dates inscribed on most of these drawings. One is the date that the dream experience happened, and then the day that I actually did the work and it got stamped and moved off of my drawing table.
What is important, though, about sort of filing these things away properly? You know what I mean?
Sure.
They're dreams, which are so intangible, and it's like you're trying to turn them into receipts.
Oh, that's a really interesting perspective. I'd never thought of it that way. For me, they're diaries, and I'm writing installments and chapters in a book. So each month is a chapter and each year is a book. And a diary is chronological often in its nature and tracks a person's experience and interactions with the world and their life chronologically. So you can revisit that perhaps have a deeper or different understanding of your life if you look at that again later in time. For me, these dream experiences have always been so vivid and so richly engaging, as richly engaging as my waking life. I want to chronicle and diary those because they are more ephemeral and they are more elusive and they are more suggestive and illogical and absurd. I don't think I'll ever clamp them down and really control my understanding of them. I think this practice has helped me become really intimate and familiar with those experiences and unafraid of illogical, absurd, ephemeral, and suggestive happenings.
Yeah. Okay. On that note about especially the suggestive happenings, I mean, the stories in these dreams, they cover the whole gamut that dreams do cover. You know, right. They can be hard to follow and mundane. They can be funny and sad or... But a lot of them are just incredibly personal and revealing, even as much as you keep commentary out of them. I mean, with like nakedness and stuff, you know.
I mean, I love nakedness, don't you?
It's stuff that I would imagine being very hard to put out there in the world as art, and especially like you do, sort of without commentary, without you know, the you who isn't in the dream doesn't come in and be like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing, but here's what happened in my dream.
Yeah, there's no director's commentary here. Well, for me, that's part of the vulnerability of being an artist. When you're seeking truthful experiences, and in our human lives, I think that's one of our responsibilities is to find authenticity and truthfulness and honesty in our daily lives. For me, it is merely describing these experiences that all of us have mentally. It's part of our brain chemistry. It's part of our evolutionary history. And I think to be demonstrative about that vulnerability helps encourage others to find what Pema Chodron calls the tenderness of the awakened heart. When we reveal our vulnerabilities, we are less threatened by them. We don't feel like we have to clamp down and protect ourselves. We understand that we're all vulnerable and we're all breakable and we're all fragile and we need to care for each other. So this act of demonstrating my own vulnerability to me is like someone showing a nude self-portrait of themselves or photographing their children as they're growing up and watching that ephemeral and vulnerable experience pass right by their eyes. Like all people, we all have that sensitivity, and this is mine.
So this whole thing of actually making the things you've seen in your dreams is new for this show.
That's right. I've never done that before.
Okay, tell me about it.
Well, Michael Schoenhoff, who's the curator at the space there, is a longtime friend, and I really respect him and his work. And when he assumed this position, he kept inviting me to coffee and then tossing in, well, you know, we should do something. I was like, yeah, okay, great. That'd be nice. So he finally said, listen, I can't afford any more coffee. You have to commit to a date and we're going to do something. So I presented him with three options of different kinds of shows that I could make with him there. And he gravitated toward the one that he knew would scare me the most, which is stuff that I don't have any experience doing and haven't done before, haven't shown or published anywhere before. And he wanted to give me the opportunity to explore new things and make myself vulnerable to new processes and new ideas. And he also wanted to be a venue where artists felt healthy and comfortable doing that. And I have to say, he and the Art Institute and all the students who are working there and the staff, April Pugh, they've all been so generous and so kind and so supportive in just creating a space where I can do interesting things.
Something you've never done before. What is it about this that you've never done before? Is it the sculpture? Is it sculpture period? Or
I've made some small scale sculpture. I've never worked at the scale of some of these works. It's been many, many years since I worked with ceramics. I haven't made found furniture sculpture before. So having to learn some new skills, having to practice new skills at a new scale or a new dimension is a very new experience for me.
And so you built things that have appeared to you in dreams. And I have no experience doing that, but the experience even just of creativity in general, of you imagine something and then you try to make it, can often be really frustrating because you will never make exactly the thing you saw in your head, which I especially think if you've seen it in a dream where it appeared to be real, and then, you know, that seems really challenging. So can we start with, like, the objects themselves that you made? This, what I called the Stonehenge of chairs. What is that? What is the deal with this chair situation?
It's really funny you call it Stonehenge because a couple of other people have called it a pyramid. And I love my work being compared to classic, you know, architecture and archaeology.
Or like architecture that strikes people as kind of mysterious in some way.
Well, I think that's a great place to start. My friend, the collector, Michael Klein, came to visit the show and we talked about it. And he was, I respect him so much, and he was urging me to be a little more descriptive of the process of from dream to drawing to object so that people could feel more included in that process. And I've thought a lot about that since he said that to me. And I find what I'm doing is giving you the experience that I've had in the dream of encountering this structure or...
Yeah, what is the dream? This, what is it?
Precisely.
Tell me.
I will share that with you, but I think you have grasped the key experience of this kind of exhibit. You're experiencing the wonder and the curiosity and the confusion and sometimes being dumbfounded the way that I do in these dreamscapes.
For sure.
That particular dream was about a very, very dear friend of mine who lost his husband to HIV. And in that dream, the late husband and I were carrying around this sculpture that I had made that was called The Structure of Understanding. And we were parading around the street in front of their house. And my friend was looking on from a distance and being very judgmental and critical, the way he always was of everything. That's what I loved about him. And that object in that dream scenario made perfect sense, and it was completely...
That was the sculpture that you had been carrying called what again?
The Structure of Understanding. So unlike having an imagined form or a design object that you want to make that you have to refine and attempt to realize according to an ideal of craft or vision, In this instance, this object was presented fully formed and it made its own sense and had its own kind of logic about it, the way things do in dreams. And it was my job, as I do with my drawings in great detail, with great objectivity, to try to help that come into three-dimensional reality with the same kind of objectivity without an overlay of artistic romance. And that was hard to avoid. That was a real lesson for me in this project, was steering clear of, oh, what would be cool, and being more honest about how did this appear and what was its three-dimensional reality with others in the dream, and how can I help that honestly come into being.
So then there's also this like rack of tinsel-y letters. What's going on with that? It's like the kind of rack you would find at a store up by the counter where they're just like the tchotchkes they're trying to...
Yeah, point of purchase to, display.
Yeah. But it's full of these, hot pink tinsel-y ABCs.
That was a really lovely dream involving a Turkish Ottoman and flying around with a friend and trying to avoid Shirley Helzberg, who was chasing me in her car with her husband Barnett. She's never done that in real life, by the way. That
and you only do name a lot of specific Kansas City names, by the way, in your dreams.
They appear there. Can't miss them. And that was a question of scale and materiality that I encountered in that dream, because I found these letters and I was going to collect them and make a big thing out of them. So I had to get that rack of letters, and there were four others that were the same size. And I wanted to make one of those because its materials and its scale and the jumbling together of letters that aren't a specific word or a specific paragraph or text that suggests the kind of knowing that we think language presents us with, or that gives us the opportunity to have. All of it, the scale, the materials, were really intriguing to me, and I think make for a sometimes awkward, sometimes beguiling viewing experience in the space. What strikes me about that piece and a few others is there's no protocol for how to view it and experience it, because you haven't seen that kind of thing before, really. When you're going to a show of paintings, you know how to stand in front of a wall and look at a painting.
Yeah.
But when you're visiting a gallery and there's a tree costume laying on the floor, or a table with a sculpture of a naked person on it, or a giant rack of glittery magenta tinsel letter forms, you're having to adjust your own expectations in front of those objects, I hope.
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, that's my experience there, but I am really curious about your experience there, because this is your subconscious landscape that you are basically physically walking into, and it's also like collapsed in time. These are dreams from over a period of decades, just specific objects from different dreams all sitting in a physical space together. That must be so weird to walk in there.
Oh, it's so normal to me, because that's how it is in my mind. That's how it is in my head. All of those things are with me all the time, every day in vivid color, and I get to walk around and look at them meaningfully, and now you do too at the gallery.
Christopher Leach, congratulations on realizing this vision.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Chance Diaries Dream Things opens tonight with a reception at the Kansas City Art Institute's Crossroads Gallery from 6 to 8. There will be an artist talk in the gallery on February 10th. Up next, a one-woman play about Diana Vreeland. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now, before Anna Wintour and The Devil Wears Prada, there was Diana Vreeland, the editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine from 1963 till 1971, and then later the driving force between the Metropolitan Museum's Costume Institute. She left a wealth of hilarious quotes. She had an uncanny sense of both her own style and the next big thing, and her personality was a force. Actress Cheryl Weaver is playing the larger-than-life character in a one-woman play, Full Gallop. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, first, tell me about, I need to say that there are many, there's some disagreement as to how to pronounce her name, but we will go with Diana. Tell me more about her, who she was, why she was legendary.
Well, she spanned an entire century in her life. She was born in 1906. She died in 1989, I believe. And she was just a person that sort of grasped hold of life and lived it full. And that's what makes this play so entertaining, I hope.
When you say that, can you give some examples? I mean, pretend that I have never heard of her and just like tell me about her. Who is this person?
Well, darling, she's the kind of woman that is always on and is always inviting people in, but at the same time, judging you just a little bit. So particularly with fashion, we have several moments in the play where if you come wearing blue jeans, I might just pick on you a little bit, just a little bit.
So, yeah, tell me the story kind of her career, first of all.
Well, she was the editor, the fashion editor at Harper's Bazaar for several years, many years, 20 years, I think. And then she left because she didn't feel like, here she was in a man's world, so she didn't feel like she was being respected or paid well. So she got the job at Vogue. And then, of course, Vogue famously fired her in 1971. She had brought the youth culture, Twiggy. She invented a whole lot of things that we know to be fashion today. And then they wanted something, you know, more youthful. And so they got rid of her. And that's the inciting incident in our play, actually.
The firing.
It is. She has just returned from abroad, having suffered through this sort of scandalous, you know, firing where all of New York is, you know, chitter-chattering about what's happened to her. And she's got to face that music and she's got to figure out what's next.
And she, in addition to being this huge person in the world of fashion, she was also a known eccentric. Mm-hmm. She was visually her own personal sense of style was really distinctive. She had like a turban period. She wore rouge that was not blended into her face.
Not
There's
at all.
A funny story I read about her being on a plane with Bill Blass. Have you read this story that a flight attendant rubbed
yes.
her rouge in for her?
In fact, that appears for a briefly moment in our play when she's talking to a friend and says, a steward has attacked me with a Kleenex because I had lipstick on my ears. so she thought. So, yeah. And that's the thing. She was so larger in life. She definitely knew how to brand herself as an entity. She was not a beautiful woman. And that's something that we discuss in the play as well. But she didn't let that stop her. In fact, she sort of let it define her.
What do you mean by that?
Well, her mother and lots of people sort of made fun of this. She had a very distinct profile. The New York Post called it the cigar store Indian looks. But she didn't let that, you know, keep her back. She was one of those people that knew her limitations and or pretended they weren't there. So she would constantly create situations out of nothing. You know, she never had any money, but she looked like a person who always had money and things like that. So that's how she just kept moving forward. She was a very American person, even though, of course, she was born in Paris and was European. I spend a lot of time talking about the European essence, but I think ultimately we had a talk back last night after the show, and someone suggested that she's very American. She's self-made. She brands herself. It's all about her appearance.
Brands and reinvents.
Every single time she has to, yes. And she did it repeatedly.
There is, she's also just, but before we get into the play itself, just because I'm not sure everyone just knows about this legendary person mm-hmm. completely other than
I did
just
not,
the name
really.
Itself. Yeah, she's a name you know, but the stories are incredible. And she also, like, she was just highly quotable.
Highly quotable.
Do you have a favorite quote?
Your imagination is your reality currently sits on my chalkboard in my kitchen. So I'll have to pick that one because I've been using it this entire time. It's not one of her funniest, but it is one I adhere to it at the moment. She wrote a column for Harper's Bazaar called Why Don't You? And it had the most bizarre things in it, like, why don't you wash your blonde children's hair in dead champagne. Now, this, remind you, is like 1937 when people are having trouble putting meat on the table, let alone dead champagne. So, but that was her. She just, let's go ahead and do this like the French do, as she would say.
So what made you want to play her?
Well, this was a kind of a thing that had happened around me. I had never heard of the play. And Bill Whitener from the ballet first approached me with that he'd seen it in New York or in Washington, perhaps, the two biggest productions, and that it would be something that I should look at. It would be perfect for me. And I read it and thought, oh, lovely. But that's as far as that went. Then, of course, Charles Ferruza did the same exact thing. And then Michael and Andy sort of approached me saying, someday we'd like to do this.
So a lot of people read this play or saw this play and thought of you.
Yeah, apparently so.
So what do you think that's about?
I don't know, because I'm nothing like her, honestly. But I do tend to play women like her a lot. So I guess I had done a production at the Unicorn of Bees and Honey Drown. And that woman is a similar. There is, you know, in Hollywood in the 50s, there was something called the Diana Vreeland type.
Ooh.
And it was written into screenplays, and she was hard-boiled, and Rosalind Russell would probably play her in a movie. And so there's, you know, she's out there in this kind of iconic, you know, archetype. And I had played a role that was similar to that, and I think that's where it all started.
So you have a background with fashion yourself, right?
Not really.
Not really.
I have costume history credits to my name. I've done some costuming. I like fashion, but I wouldn't say, like, you can't see me, and thank goodness for it, because I'm not terribly fashionable today.
I would beg to differ, honestly.
Oh, okay.
But so you're going to play Diana Vreeland, and you read this play, which is positioned, you know, this moment when she's just been fired from Vogue very publicly in 1971. Talk to me about that moment and where you see the heart of that drama.
Well, that, again, is the inciting moment. That's what creates the drama. She's in denial a lot of the play. She's invited the audience in for an evening to sort of entertain them and lecture them. But at the same time, she's putting together a dinner party with wealthy people that she hopes will back her in whatever she wants to do. And none of that, you know, works out. So there's your conflict. A lot of people want her to take this Costume Institute job. And it's sort of seen by her and others as a sort of place to put a 70, almost 70-year-old woman. And then she can sort of, you know, wait out her days looking at costumes behind glass cases. Well, she's going to have none of that, of course. So ultimately, of course, she does take that job. But she makes it her own and turns it into their charity event. The Met Gala to this day is one of the premier events, not just fashion, but in all of New York. It's the place where Beyonce and Sarah Jessica Parker appear with their wildest gowns. So, and she invented that.
Most of us cannot relate to being in the exact kind of situation that Diana Vreeland was in. You know, like she's in this very visible public position, like top of an industry, shaping people's, I don't know, shaping style, shaping taste, and in headlines, you know. But if for her to be the main character of this play, that means that there is something sort of universally relatable about her situation. And I wonder what you think that is.
Well, it's probably that ability to sort of just keep going. Again, very American, that we don't let things get us down. And there's an admirable quality of that, which I don't know if people are like, but they want to be like. And I think people admired her, you know, sort of chutzpah.
That's something I wanted to get to, is that when people talk about Diana Vreeland, they talk in a combination usually of admiration and sort of like maybe a little bit of mockery too.
Yeah, sure. She was certainly made fun of at the same time during her lifetime and well afterwards. But she also, there are drag characters named after her. So, you know, she has a that bigger than life quality is admirable in that respect. And then oddly, I've had a lot of young teenage people come to the show and they are familiar with her. Like she's had a resurface, which is new to me. I wasn't aware that was true. But I think if you follow not just fashion, but New York, you know, icons, that she appears. And, you know, she was mentioned, I think it was last season on Project Runway, which is the only fashion show I watch. And someone said, we have a Dionne of Vreeland moment here. And I thought, oh, okay, well, there you go. It's that much in the zeitgeist.
So the way she talked, like her way of phrasing things, even just hearing you talk about her column where she said that she had a column called Why Don't You? And that one of her suggestions is why don't you wash your blonde children's hair in dead champagne?
Yes.
I mean, that is, talk to me as someone who plays her about some of the lines in the play. Do you have favorite lines? And did you have to embrace this way of talking?
Well, first of all, I had to embrace the way she physically talks, which you can hear it in my voice today because I did a show last night. She had a very harsh, sort of abrasive vocal quality. So I'm trying to match that. I spent some time looking at documentaries, which if you want to know more about her, just Google her. There's a lot out there. And then there are these tremendous quotes that she has, none of which I can remember at the moment because I'm completely blanking. But in the play, I love things like, she mentions at one point in time, she's talking about how things used to be with facelifts, that all the way back to Louis Couture's, he pulled his hair or his skin up under his wig where there were maggots, and the doctors left the maggots there because the maggots ate the poison, which she finds delightful. That's her word for it. While the audience almost always goes, ew.
And she's going, this is delightful.
She's going, delightful. Yes, exactly. So that's how she looks at everything. It's always interesting to her. And not for nothing, she was quite the historian. She really did understand a lot about not where just fashion, but where fashion sat in history.
I read one of the stories I read about her that I liked was that at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she was the driving force behind that costume institute, there was a display where someone was trying to get a mannequin's hair sort of perfectly set, and her criticism was no, more like concrete, which is a little bit mysterious and unclear. And then when he got it right, she said, now she's ready for the guillotine.
There you go. That is a perfect example of her.
So is there something that you have learned from her in the process of studying her, playing her?
Well, she requires you to be bold. I have to have an interplay with the audience. You know, it's a one-woman show, so there's no other character on stage, no other actor on stage for me to, you know, create and play off of and do all of those things. So the audience becomes the de facto second character. So it requires an awful lot of faith on my part and theirs to, you know, create this evening every night. And so it requires me to be pretty risky. I have to talk directly to them. Every once in a while, I have to sort of cajole them. There's a little bit of improv because of it. That's not usually my comfort zone, but she is a person that would have said to me, go for it. Don't even stop. Don't even think about it, you know. And that's something I always want to do better. So I love her for that she's given me a little boldness.
And you do her makeup, I imagine.
I do.
Describe that process.
Well, it's shockingly, she didn't use a lot of eye makeup. She came of age in the 30s and 40s and 50s. So it's a lot of lip, very red lip, a lot of blush, because that was how she'd find herself. You blush all the way to the ear line, so your ears are blushed too. And then brows and a little bit of liner. So think of a sort of 50s face in the extreme.
Cheryl Weaver, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Full Gallop is at the Just Off Broadway Theater through February 11th. It's a one woman play about Dionne of Vreeland. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we have to take a quick break, but we will be back to hear about upcoming shows with the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra. In fact, we're hearing their music now. Stay tuned. This is the music of the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra, a local group trying to preserve the Kansas City sound. I'm Gina Kaufman, and rounding out our first Friday art show, we've got the artistic director of the group with us now, Clint Ashlock. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are we hearing that evokes a Kansas City sound?
This is the first movement of Benny Carter's Kansas City Suite. It sounds like Vine Street Rumble. And it's got the rhythmic feel, the blues language, and the soul of what makes Kansas City jazz, Kansas City jazz.
When you say the rhythmic feel, what is the rhythmic feel of the Kansas City sound?
There's this kind of jubilant, what we call four on the floor, a walking bass, kind of a shuffle feel in the drums. That's
Yeah, the shuffle, I think. Yeah. I was trying to figure out a word for that because it does feel, yeah, classic.
Yeah, it's very engaging. It's I heard Wynton Marsalis talk about it as being the perfect combination between the two classic rhythmic motives, which is the march and the waltz. You know, you got 1-2, 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, doom, da doom, da doom, da doom. That's a shuffle, which of course turned into swing, ting, ting, a ting, ting, a ting. And this is how we talk, by the way.
I love it.
But yeah, that's a very, very common Kansas City sound.
So, you know, the people's idea of jazz in 2018 can be very like heady and avant-garde. And the thing that jumps out to me as I listen to your music is that it feels more dancey or like, you know what I mean? That it doesn't feel like avant-garde jazz.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even, you know, in the most far out, I guess if you want to call it jazz music, to the most sort of historically grounded, which, I mean, jazz originally was dance music. It was party music. But I think the best music has to engage the listener as much as it engages the practitioner. This is an opinion, but it's definitely more overt in the music that we play. It's an infectious, and it's based out of the dance, you know, kind of tradition that jazz accompanied.
You formed this group in 2003, and calling yourselves the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra, I hope you don't mind my saying so, but I find it bold.
I agree. I wasn't around in 2003, but I'm glad they picked that name. It's informed what I'm trying to do here in my position that I've been in since 2013, which is to try and show respect for, to try and practice, and then to try and pursue what an authentically Kansas City big band sound might be. So we have a little bit to live up to, I think, with that kind of bold proclamation. But
yeah, like that you are sort of the definitive representation of that sound.
Well, I mean, we hope to be, you know, at least one of them. There are many in Kansas City, but we definitely hope to be one of those for sure.
You have a show coming up called Evening at the Savoy that actually, do I understand right, that it harkens back to the Harlem Renaissance?
Mm-hmm. That's the theme.
Talk to me about it.
Well, the Kansas City, Kansas Public Libraries have had us do a series of concerts or dances or both. And this year, and they always have themes. So this year it's the Savoy and the Harlem Renaissance. And it's tied in, of course, to literary things, being the library. But we are going to play some music that we put on a concert that it didn't celebrate the racism of the Cotton Club. It celebrated the music and sort of the emergence in the face of racism. That's a longer story that Duke Ellington and those guys did.
Yeah, can you explain a little what you're referring to for people who aren't familiar?
Sure. Well, there was a club called the Cotton Club in New York City, and it was run by white gangsters. And they had a really racist sort of way of hiring the people that worked and played music there. And then the people that would attend would be all white. So Duke Ellington had the house band, and he wrote this music that sort of transcended that and used his position as a really popular musical person to kind of move past the inherent racism of that club. I mean, even the name of that club. So we, a couple of years ago, we took the music from that era and we presented it at the Kauffman Center. And it was a whole lot of fun. That early Ellington music is fantastic, and Cab Calloway and other folks do. So now we're going to revisit some of that music and some other things that we didn't do on that concert to present an evening of historically grounded but contemporarily swinging jazz music.
So it seems to me that Kansas City is just one piece of a larger thing for you. I mean, it seems like this group likes to capture a moment and a mood from history, a particular time and place, through music.
I would agree with that. That's something that I've actively tried to program. We have four concerts a season, and to try and present something from somewhere or sometime that could be engaging to the public.
What do you think it is about music in particular that can transport you in that way and that can ground you in a particular time and place?
Well, it's abstract, you know, and I think that we, as humans, we feel some sort of a pull in some direction by things that are abstract. I'm trying to shorten whatever's going on in my brain right now, but there are sounds and there are feelings and there are rhythms that immediately evoke a thought or a representation of a place or a time or a person that other things don't really do. I think. I mean, art in general does this. I think abstraction can cause a very vibrant response.
I think also music. Maybe the way that your body responds to music, like that you sort of feel like you're going to start dancing a little bit or something, like it makes you, it takes you along in a different kind of way.
It does. That's a great representation of what I think music does. I mean, it makes your body move. What is that? You know, that's just such an interesting response that we have, but everyone has it, from, you know, babies to the elderly.
Next month, you are planning a show with music written entirely by women, and this is not a coincidence.
No, it's not. I started in 2013, and immediately, this is a concert that I really wanted to program. I have two daughters, and I'm increasingly aware of just the huge disparity between the sexes in jazz music. It's primarily male. And there's such a great amount of music that has been produced, written, recorded by women that maybe doesn't get as much notoriety as the rest of the music that we program. Stan Kenton, you know, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and so forth. But it's rich and it's wonderful. And I thought, with our you know, we have a bit of a platform at the Kauffman Center, and we have a lot of people that come to our shows, and this was a great opportunity. And I mean, we're doing it mindfully that we are a band made up of all men, which is, but hopefully this could be the starting point to, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road to not have a Kansas City Jazz Orchestra of all males.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like that is a conundrum in a lot of areas,
yeah.
Just that if there has been some kind of historic inequality, fixing that requires the people who are in positions of power within that field. So in this case, jazz, sort of taking up the mantle of changing it, which, yeah, there is some awkwardness in that.
Yeah. And I mean, just trying to do it with the mindfulness of, you know, how far I still have to come, you know, and how far our organizations do, but doing it with integrity and just really celebrating this great music that maybe hasn't been performed as much as it should.
Tell me about some of the women you've learned about in this process, or maybe you already knew about them.
Oh man, well, so I was really excited for very specific pieces. I knew that I wanted to do them on the concert, and we only have, you know, 10 or 12 songs that we can do. But like there's there's music by Mary Lou Williams, who is a Kansas City sort of superstar with Andy Kirk. And then she developed many, many different iterations of herself over time. We're doing one of her great tunes called Roll 'em, which is kind of a classic Kansas City sound. And then there's music by Billie Holiday. Of course, she wrote God Bless the Child. And we're going to do that song. But then some more, maybe lesser known, but still amazing music. Maria Schneider's a pretty well-known Grammy Award-winning big band composer and arranger.
I will tell you, I'm embarrassed to say, because you said she's pretty well-known. I've never heard of her. Tell me about her.
She treats a jazz orchestra or a big band or whatever you want to call it. Those two are synonymous. She treats them very orchestrally. She gets a lot of textures and timbres and beautiful sounds that you maybe wouldn't normally hear in a traditional sounding dance band or a big band. But it's still, she's really interested in dance. So her music always has this beautiful flowing quality to it. And trying to choose one of Maria Schneider's many ridiculously amazing arrangements was difficult. But we decided to go with one of her arrangements of a well-known standard, so that might bring people in because they might know that song, but now they know Maria Schneider did it. So we're going to do her arrangement of My Ideal. And then there's Carla Bley, who was sort of this iconoclastic composer in the 70s and 80s. And she had some really nice big band music. So we're doing kind of a gospel thing that she did. It's funky and it's soulful and features a trombone soloist, which, you know, everybody loves trombone.
That's probably true. You've posted on Facebook about this show, Lady Be Good,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, talking about jazz being a very male-dominated genre and talking about the sort of challenges in taking on gender inequality as an entirely male orchestra. And I'm curious about the response. I mean, were people engaged in this conversation? Did anyone bring up something that surprised or interested you or took your thinking on this further?
Well, the most memorable comment definitely came from Deborah Brown, who is a fantastic singer. I mean, she's my favorite singer on the planet today. No offense to everyone else, but and a Kansas Cityan. And she mentioned, you know, playing music by Melba Liston, which we're doing an arrangement of hers on the concert. And you know, just some of the sobering realities of, you know, it's like, well, she didn't say this, but literally, but you know, you're doing this and but just remember, you know, there's this and this and this and this and this, and
what are those things?
Well, to summarize, there's more to do, I suppose. There's always more steps that you can take. There's more acknowledging of this huge disparity of what is happening.
Can you give some examples from within the world of jazz?
That it's I don't know what the percentage would be, but I'm guessing 75% male dominated. The industry is hugely dominated. The practitioners are male dominated, and
even the people who usually talk about jazz, honestly,
are all male. And you know, and so Deborah didn't say this literally, but it evoked the idea of this is not an equal platform. This is not something that is great yet, but we can take the steps to get there.
I like that, you know, as we're going out, it's this push and pull between history, the history of jazz, and the future.
Yeah, I do too. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Well, we are going to have to run off, but Clint Ashlock of the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra, what are we listening to now?
This is an arrangement of mine of George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm that we did a couple years ago that it was super easy to put together. The saxophones had a good time with it.
Well, thank you for stopping by and talking with me, Clint.
Thanks for having me.
The Kansas City Jazz Orchestra's next show, A Night at the Savoy, will be at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library on February 17th, and you can catch Lady Be Good, that all-women's show, next month at the Kauffman Center's Helzberg Hall. That's March 9th. That's it for today's show. And for the week, you can listen back to anything you enjoyed or catch up on shows you missed at kcur.org/Central Standard. Yesterday, we heard from a Kansas Cityan just back from Puerto Rico about life on the ground there. His observations are worth a listen. KCUR.org/Central Standard. We are produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Our usual theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.